Hello, everybody. This is Trace again with the Doomer Optimism podcast. We are back with an amazing couple of guests and hosts. We've got Dave back again, aspiring peasant, to help me co-host with Paul Wheaton. So, Dave, take it away.
Hey, guys. Welcome back. We have today a super, super exciting guest, the Duke of Permaculture. Now, I know that when I first heard Paul call himself the Duke of Permaculture or reference that, I was like, oh, come on, man. But then I realized, like, he got that nickname from Sepp Holzer and Jeff Lawton. And if those two guys call you something, you put that crown on and you just wear it with pride. And that's the only way to respond to that. Because if you don't know who Sepp Holzer are and who Sepp Holzer and Jeff Lawton are, Paul's going to get into it. But like, those are definitely some guys, some books you're for sure going to want to look up. The fun thing about Paul is that he's more than just a symbolic despot. He's like a real life tyrant too, presiding over like a digital and real dukedom that includes permies.com, which is an amazing forum for resources. Rich Soil, which is Paul's blog, which he has articles on everything from like chicken tractors to how to properly care for cast iron, which I'm pretty sure Paul's answer is let the dog lick it and leave it in the sink. He's also got this perpetual Kickstarter engine. If you're watching, I've got at least two Kickstarters right here. Strong recommend for those if the content is interesting to you. He's also got a YouTube channel, podcast, and my personal favorite project of his is a 300 acres of real world experiments, which is called Wheaton Labs. But before we get to all of those awesome things that I'm genuinely excited to talk about. Paul, you weren't always this dude walking around the woods in overalls showing people where you poop and the willows that love this poop. You started off as a software engineer in the aerospace industry, and now you wear overalls professionally and tinker with like low energy alternative lifestyles. Can you tell us how that happened?
Well, first of all, I'm a little amazed that, you know, it's not like everybody wears overalls. What's wrong with you people? I mean, this is ridiculously comfortable. I don't understand why people don't just wear overalls all the time. Everybody. There's this weird fashion industry keeping you from overalls or something twisted. I'm not sure what the conspiracy is there, but overalls are clearly the answer. I'm glad we had this chat, got that all worked out.
We'll wrap the podcast now. Done.
Yeah, overalls good. Are good. I got it.
Paul Wheaton out.
So, in fact, here we go. So you're asking about my software engineering days. Can you read that? I don't know. Got enough light?
Bananacom?
Okay.
So, clean modem software.
So basically it was the 90s. People were getting connected to online services. And I felt like all the software sucks. The short version is I wrote some software back then. But by then I was already a pretty well-known software engineer. And then eventually, yeah, went into aerospace. I did a lot, but right. In 2004, I was working on a gig. I could talk about the gig forever, but the big thing is that it's like I was already keen on permaculture, and I kind of felt like, why isn't permaculture a household word? And I came to this conclusion that maybe I can change that. Maybe I can, I think I can do a big thing, but I would have to totally drop this very lucrative career. So I did. I let go of a very lucrative career. I think I had an amazing reputation and I think I was in the top 1%, but maybe there's some people in the software engineering world that would argue with that. But still, the big thing is I walked away and I fired up permies.com and started doing all kinds of stuff to try to advance permaculture stuff. I started putting videos up on YouTube when there weren't very many people doing it, I think. I know that I posted the first ever video about a rocket mass heater. And then after a few years of posting, YouTube said, hey, we'll give you some money if you want. Whereas now it seems like a lot of people that get into YouTube for the money, I'm kind of curious how much they get because I don't get very much from YouTube, but I did post a lot of videos with no thought of monetary advancement. I traveled, visited a lot of permaculture places, a lot of gardens and farms, and took videos and posted those and talked about them at permies.com, and everything just kind of grew. And then next thing you know, I'm meeting Seth Holzer and Jeff Lawton and these other people. And so I don't know, somehow, and I can't seem to stop. There's definitely been a lot of incidents that I think most people would have given it up. But I'm pretty obsessed about making a bigger difference. And yeah, you mentioned my place, kind of a play on words with Bill Nye, the science guy. He had Nye Labs. So I said, okay, this is Wheaton Labs. It's the same. It's exactly the same, only it's completely different. So we do a lot of experimenting here. And I do think we're well on our way to becoming kind of a permaculture Disneyland of sorts. I could probably fill a couple hundred hours just talking about the experiments we're doing. There, did I answer your question?
Yeah. Sure. It's a good starting point. Before we get into I have a bunch of questions about everything you just said, but actually the first one I want to ask is, tell us about one of your setbacks, like a big setback. You said there are a bunch of setbacks that should have stopped you, perhaps would have stopped a lot of people. What happened and why didn't you stop?
Well, I made a podcast a long time ago. I've got like, I don't know, do I have 600 podcasts now? I think I have 600.
At least 500. Yeah, you have a lot.
And so podcast number 111 keeps coming up because you asked this question and it was kind of like, this is what I kind of talk. And the title of the podcast is, why are our permaculture leaders such dicks? And really the answer comes down to because our permaculture community makes them that way. And so I use Yonto Evans as an example. Not only somebody that I've met, visited with many times, but I know a lot of people in his network. And I've heard the stories over and over and over again. And it's kind of like, so Yonto invents an amazing thing, rocket stoves and rocket mass heaters. And then he shows it to somebody and this person who he's showing it to and he's trying to impress says, that's stupid. And then Yonto patiently explains to him how it's not stupid. Let me help you to understand what's going on here. Oh, okay, all right. And so then as the thousands of people come by saying that's stupid, eventually he starts to lose his patience. And then after about 20,000 people, his response is, well, fuck off then. Don't look at it. It's not for you. And so it's like, so we basically made him be a dick. Another way of looking at it is I think truly kind and pleasant, lovely people, when they get the that's stupid or other unkindness directed towards them, I think that they're like, I'm out. I'm not going to share anymore. I'm going to go do amazing permaculture things, but I'm not going to share it anymore. It's just not worth the hate. So one of the big reasons for creating permies.com is that when the haters come around, we delete that. And so then when you go there and you look at it, I imagine both of you probably got and looked at a whole bunch of stuff out there. And it's like, what a bunch of nice people with nice things to say. And it's like,
yeah, that's because you get deleted and got rid of the turds.
Whoa, man. It's probably one of the most heavily moderated sites on the internet.
Oh, but I believe it.
I think it's really moving permaculture forward. Now we can finally kind of talk about it. And when these awful people come around, we just delete that. So, and as much as I've gotten a lot of ugly directed towards me, and I'm sure both of you are familiar with at least some of it, nothing compared to Jeff Lawton and Seth Holzer, who you guys just mentioned a moment ago. I mean, Seth Holzer, a woman wrote a book about how much she hated Seth Holzer. And eventually she decided to sue Seth Holzer. And so Seth Holzer countersued. And at the end, the judge says, okay, here's what I've decided. Okay, hey, lady, everything you own is now the property of Seth Holzer, and you get to spend 3 years in the pokey. So we're all familiar with Seth Holzer's Kramaterhof, which he gave to his son. And now Seth Holzer's got this brand new property that he calls Holzerhof. which I think is especially sweet considering it is the property that used to belong to that woman.
So the
key is that it's like this stuff, I think it's the unusualness of it, the thing that it's a big leap, the things that we're talking about. And for people that might be a little, let's suppose they're a little weak in the head or a little slow on the uptake, it's too much. And so instead of saying, help me to understand this, they say, bullshit. That's a bunch of lies. You're selling snake oil. And then if they say it in a public forum someplace, then other people who are new to it, observers, they're like, oh, well, I thought it sounded neat, but apparently it's bullshit. So I think that this is where getting permaculture to be a household word got gummed up, is with these people that are struggling to understand it. I think a rather perfect example is rocket mass heaters.
Yes, let's talk about those. What are they?
You can heat your home with 1/10 the wood. And there are people, engineers. So I'm an engineer. There are people out there that are engineers and they say bullshit, lies. You are suggesting that you can violate the laws of physics. And here's how they get there. There is a conventional wood stove at the wood stove store that says it has an efficiency of 75%. And so if I'm claiming that I can heat with 1/10 the wood, then I'm claiming that I can heat with 750% efficiency, which is a number that is larger than 100%.
However, by a few percent, yeah.
So what they're saying is the government tells the true, Paul Wheaton's a lying sack of shit. And so it's kind of like, I don't know. Has anybody ever noticed some spin coming from the government? So here's the deal. It says 75% efficiency, but the government allows 16% for what goes up the chimney. So it's actually 59% efficient. But that's a 59% efficiency that's from a third-party laboratory. And the third-party laboratories are competing with each other. They do all kinds of things to try to get a really good number, legitimately, in their laboratory. But they will like kiln dry the wood and they will increase the air pressure in the house or in the room so that it's effectively blowing on the fire. And then they'll do like 20 burns and then they'll keep the best number. Now, so they got a 59% was their best number. Maybe their average was like 50, but that's in their specialized
in beautiful, conditions. Perfect laboratory conditions set up because the incentives are to make these things sound more efficient than they perhaps are. So tell us about rocket mass heaters specifically. What's different about
them? Let me get down. I'm almost to the finish line here. So then the thing is that the average person is probably gonna, on their best burn, run it at about 30% efficient. But then what a lot of people do with wood, when they're heating with wood, is it's like, well, I want the fire to go all night. So they'll put a wet piece of wood, a giant wet log, inside the firebox, and they'll turn the dampers down really low to keep that fire going really slow all night long. Now you're using your 75% efficient wood stove to burn at 3% efficiency. Oh, but wait, there's more. Once the fire goes out, there's still warmth in there. Air is still moving through the system, even though the fire is out. So the heat that's in the house is going into the firebox and up the chimney.
Sucks to try that cap, yeah.
Now you're running at negative efficiency. So I don't know. I think creating a device that heats your home with 1/10 the wood compared to all that is actually a pretty easy task. So basically what we're doing is, because the other thing is that if you run a conventional wood stove, if you don't operate it correctly, you could have a chimney fire. What a rocket mass heater does is it domesticates the chimney fire. So a regular wood stove, when you run the fire, it's going to extract the heat right away. So you might get a temperature of like 900 degrees. And it's like, and you're getting the heat out of the box immediately. And whatever's left goes up the chimney, which, by the way, what goes up the chimney, you're pretty much required by law to have a temperature of 350 degrees as a minimum, but they usually go 350 to 600 as what goes out the chimney, and for good reason. But with a rocket mass heater, we're generally shooting for temperatures in the 120 to 160 range. So we're keeping a lot more heat inside. Again, making it so it's really easy to heat your home with 1/10 the wood. All right, so conventional wood stove, metal box, fire in box, heat comes out immediately. Rocket mass heater, insulated box. So we have an insulated chamber where we run the fire, getting the temperature up to pushing 2000 degrees Fahrenheit. And then we run it up and out. And then after we've burned all the smoke and we've burned all the creosote, now we start extracting the heat from it. So we insulate the fire in the beginning. That's the big trick. The other thing is that afterwards we get like probably about 70% of the heat goes into the room immediately. The remaining 30% goes out to a mass, leaving like about 5% to go out the vertical exhaust. So the mass gets warmed up during the fire. And then the mass gives off heat for the next couple of days. This makes it so that you can burn a heat wide open. You burn a fire wide open and very efficiently. And then when it's all done, you cork it. And then you can go to bed. And then all night long, that mass is giving off heat. You wake up in the morning and the building is still warm, as opposed to that conventional wood stove where if the fire goes out, you might wake up to frozen pipes. And so that's why a lot of people with a conventional wood stove, they're getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to build another fire just to keep their pipes and their building from freezing. The rocket mass heater, we don't have that problem. So we're much more comfortable. We heat with 1/10 the wood, and what goes out the chimney is generally clear. I've got a great video on YouTube. It's like a rocket mass heater clean or something like that. But we have a fire going as a demonstration, and you can see the fire going. And then there's the exhaust, and a guy comes over and sticks his hand in the exhaust. We say, what's the temperature feel like? He says, I don't know, like room temperature, I guess. And a woman sticks her face in the exhaust while it's going, and she breathes it in. And it's like, okay, what do you smell? She says, well, I smell smoke, but there's not smoke. Hmm. And I'm kind of thinking like, and of course the number one feature is you don't see the skin on her face peeling off and catching on fire and things like that.
That is key. That is key.
Yeah. Always an important feature. So, in fact, there's enough water in there. Maybe it's a moisturizing thing, good for your skin to do. I don't know. I'm not going to suggest anybody do that. I was a little surprised that she did it. I'm sitting here with the video, videoing her, and then she suddenly sticks her face in it. That's like, I think
maybe not recommended, but she didn't burn, which is key.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and she did breathe it in, which is key. And didn't have a coughing fit. And she says she could smell smoke. I think that, you know, when this thing gets going, it puts out less pollutant than a candle. So a very clean burn. And if people are preppers, a very clean burn means that you're not giving away a smoke trace. So if you've got your bug out location and you got a rocket mass heater in there and you're heating yourself with that, no smoke trace for people to find out where you are.
One of the other things I love about rocket mass heaters, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that you can use coppiced wood pretty efficiently in it as well.
Yeah.
Like smaller branches.
You could use small stuff, big stuff, whatever you want. There's a commercial rocket mass heater available called the Liberator. And it's
isn't that a vibrator?
Is it a vibrator? I haven't noticed it vibrating, but you know, but maybe as the pellets move through it, maybe it vibrates a little bit. Mm. But you know, you might have to look into that. An extra selling point, perhaps.
It's a feature.
But it does well as a pellet stove. So the Liberator, it's sold here in the United States. It's UL listed, a commercial rocket mass heater that you can buy off the shelf and plug it into your home wherever wood stoves are allowed. And generally people use it with a pellet feed. So, but it's a smaller system. And because it get UL listed, they had to do a bunch of stuff that's a little bit different than what we normally do in the rocket mass heater world. And so it heats with, it'll heat your home with like 1/3 the pellets, but in a pinch, you can also just run regular stick wood, but it's got a small wood feed, so you can't feed a lot of sticks to it at once. Hmm. But I think it really shines as a pellet wood stove. But I advocate for people to build their own, and we produce a bunch of movies and stuff so people can build their own.
I will we'll include some links to Rocket Mass Heater themed things on Permies in the show notes for sure. So that's one experiment. Rocket Mass Heater is like a big experiment you guys are running. There's a bunch of other experiments that I'm really excited about. One of my favorite ones is the Wafati. Can you tell us about that? Also, what is the why do you call it a Wafati, and what is it and how is it working?
All right. It's an above ground structure. I don't want anybody to call it an underground thing because
bermed, right? Bermed.
It's a berm structure. So basically it's an above ground structure with a thick earthen roof, but there's some other stuff going on underneath that thick earthen roof, but it's a log structure. So we build these things because where I'm at up in Montana, I have too many trees. I have oodles and oodles and oodles of trees. So I'm building stuff out of the trees. We do a lot of roundwood timber framing. So we build these structures with logs, and then we cover it up with dirt thicker than roof, but it's not underground. It's definitely at ground level. and then first of all, we're trying to get it to the point where we can build them fast enough that if you were to pay an experienced crew to build it, it would be cheaper than a conventional home. So most of the things that are, I don't know, say environmentally friendly, you know, natural building, things that you build with your own materials off of your own
land, they take so long.
And so if you're going to have it built for you, it's going to cost more than a conventional stick-built home. And part of that is because you got so many people that have optimized that process in so many different ways. So, but what I want to do is to have this design so that it'll be cheaper. And I think we're about there. And, but wait, there's more. the idea is to harvest the heat from the summer to heat the structure through a Montana winter.
Annualized thermal inertia.
Exactly. So that's ATI and Wafati. So the W is for woodland. It's so bizarre to me that people build straw bale homes and they're like 500 miles away from the nearest bale of straw. So they got to import it all. And the other thing is I've seen people with log cabins and it's like that's a beautiful.
It's like Finnish wood brought over to the Pacific Northwest from Finland.
Yeah. Or, well, usually to me, it seems like it's Canada, but yeah. It's like, you know, why didn't you build it out of the wood that's right here? I don't know. So it's like, and then on top of that, so much is changing in the logging industry. I've got so much to say about that as well, but skippity, skippity, skip.
Another time.
Woodland. O is for, Ehler, so he spells his name O-E-H-L-E-R. Mike Ehler is the author of the $50 and Up Underground House book. So this book, he talks about building himself a house for $50. So it sounds like, okay. So you had a lot of cardboard and a lot of glue, is that right? And no.
Highway overpass.
Yeah, right. So no, he did it out of logs. And so... basically, the Wafati design is based largely on Mike Ehler's design. So the O in Wafati is a tip of the hat to Mike Ehler, who, by the way, has been out here several times before he died. And he's a friend. He's a bud. In fact, the Skip book starts off talking about Mike because the Skip book, and so that's kind of a, maybe you're going to, you ask me about Mike here a little bit. We'll talk about the Skip book.
He's on my list.
So W-O-F. F is for freaky cheap. And then, of course, the ATI for annualized thermal inertia. So there, did I answer your question? Wafati. What is a Wafati? Why should I care? Like that?
Yeah, so it's a bermed round wood structure harvested from from the place where it's being built. What's special about it though? Like, what's actually good about it?
I would say the ability to build it quickly is good. A strong structure. I think it's a rather handsome, but for certain preppers, if there's the aesthetic that I think a lot of preppers be like, oh, that is the best thing ever. And that is that the aesthetic is, it's invisible.
It's not there until you walk around it.
And so Mike Ehler has this great story of a guy who built a four-bedroom Ehler structure on 2 acres. So this is a four-bedroom home on 2 acres. And this was somewhere in Europe. And so the Department of Making You Sad showed up, and this guy was messing around in his garden. And they said, we understand you built a home without a permit. And so we think we have to, like, you know, fine you and maybe even destroy the building. And the guy says, well, if you could point it out to me, I guess you're right. And I'll have to, you know, go along with all these things you're saying. But they couldn't see it. It was invisible. So the thing is that when you build these things and it's got a thick earthen roof, lots of growies can grow on that thick earthen roof. And so if you could build it in such a way that it's very flashy and everybody can see everything, or you build it in such a way where lots of light gets in, but as the growies grow around it, the aesthetic of the building is that it's invisible. It isn't seen.
Do you live in the Wafadi?
I don't live in a Wafadi right now. No.
So why not?
What you see behind me is not a Wafadi.
Yeah.
So why not? Haven't finished. In fact, both of them, I think the first one is getting water to it this week. And so, I mean, granted, like, I'm talking to you right now over Starlink, so I could get my internet up there. We have a solar system up there, but there's currently not water there. Plus, we built a 400-square-foot structure. The first one's a 400-square-foot structure, mostly to kind of, you know, test the theory.
Proof of concept,
And do the tests. And so last year was the first annualized thermal inertia test, and I could talk about that in a minute. But your question is why don't I live in one right now? And it's kind of like, you know, I got to tell you, people who get land, there's a thing that happens. And everybody who gets brand new land, by the time that they're, like, the day before they're moving onto the land, they have a list of 726 things that they're going to get done in the first day. And it's like, and then they're angry with themselves that they only got 4 of those things done, because they were sure they were going to do all 726 things on the first day. And then after 7 years, they're a little bit pissed with themselves that they've only knocked out 150 of those things. And it's like, this is just the list of the things for the first day. And so I think it's a pretty common thing. Now, I've got a bunch of people who live here and we're all working on things, but it's kind of like the boot camp that we have here is basically a school. And so we get people who've never held a drill before. We got to get them up to speed, and we're teaching them all this stuff. And so everything kind of happens in slow motion. It's getting built and things are getting done. But I got to tell you, before I walked onto the land, I thought we'd have 4 Wafadis built the first year. And so currently we have 2 built. Well, yeah, I'm going to say, I'll just go ahead and say, I'd probably be more accurate to say 1.5. And we're still working on finishing number 1 to 100%. It's quite finished. And we have that new greenhouse. I don't know if you guys have seen the movie about the greenhouse, mm-hmm. but that's using all of our latest Wafadi stuff. And I think the movie turned out great. Really good roundwood timber framing techniques in there. Really good annualized thermal inertia tests results from that. But at the same time, none of our Wafadis have fully running water there yet. And even when they do, I'm not sure if I'm moving up right away or anything like that. It's like we've got a lot more work to be done, a lot more testing to do, and everything's just going so slowly. Yeah, I think I could be fine there, but then there's so much more, like being able to manage all the events and manage all the people and stuff. And base camp is where most of the activity still happens.
Okay, so part of the reason is that you're living in the center of activity in Wheaton Labs, and the Wolfatty is far up.
Right, right.
That's so that's okay. That makes perfect sense. Yeah,
it's a mile away as the crow flies, and so yeah, we've got two properties.
Yeah.
What I really like about your answer, Paul, is it's actually like really dovetailing with a book that I just finished called 4,000 Weeks. And like essentially your response is, I haven't moved in yet because the project is moving at the speed of life, right? It's happening at the speed at which things happen, right? And one of the themes of this book is it's a self-help book, but it's very much, it's much more like a philosophy book about what time means. Well, how would you manage time if you don't even understand what time is, right? And one of those things is that like, you know, the imposition of the clock, if you will, and calendars, the way we operate, have imposed this kind of false sense of time passing, when really like time just passes at the speed it passes. And when you're building, when you're doing stuff this close to the land and this close to the source, right, you're much more in tune with the passing of time on a human scale, you know, at, you're dealing with all these other people's schedules and all these other people's priorities. So things are just moving at the speed they move, right?
That is all true. And on top of all of that, my role right now seems to be dominantly to harvest coin. And so until we're totally self-sufficient, somebody's got to pay for all the stuff, all the tools, the materials, the vehicles, all of the things to support all of the people that are here doing, you know, what they're doing to move everything forward. So a big part of that is like, you know, the Kickstarters that you mentioned. I do all these Kickstarters on a regular basis, and that's our operating capital, which I think if you look at it, you do a Kickstarter, you get like our last one got, I think, like 70 grand. And so it's like probably about half of that goes to, you know, that product. And then the other half I can use, but then I use it to subsidize our events. And then, of course, pay for all the other things that we do here. Mm-hmm. And so it's like that's not a lot of. So what do we got? Like $20,000, $25,000 left over for operating capital each year. I mean, I think we get by on very little, right? And we're going to need to get even better and better and better at that with every passing year. But you know, so I got it. That's my role. That's mm-hmm. you know. So and then in the meantime, everybody else gets to do all the things I want to do. But you know, that doesn't pay enough to pay for things.
So one thing I love about that answer, and this is part of the conversation, is that one of the questions we got on Twitter when we asked, like, hey, what should we ask? Somebody asked, like, wanted you to talk about actually exactly this, talking about like failures that like things that you perceive as possible failures of permaculture. One is, you know, people are jerks sometimes. But another one that that The Last Farm brought up was that a lot of people talk about permaculture as though you can buy your acreage, move on to it, throw up a cabin, and then you can live this life and just live off the land. Like the amount of in time and effort and coin invested in getting things set up to grow, getting things set up to support your life, and the time and effort it takes to do all that is so much more significant than people realize. So I really appreciate how honest you are about it. You've been there how long? 8 years now? Almost 10 years?
Nine years.
There we go. 9 years. Yeah. So like, and it's still just a project in its fledgling stage.
I think, like if you watched the tour movie, I don't know, we made a tour movie last year.
I've seen the short YouTube version. I haven't, okay. Haven't paid good for the longer version.
Good enough. So what is that called? 65 things in 9 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's like, in 8 years, so it was filmed last year. It was filmed more than a year ago. I would have to say that what you see in that little YouTube video, I think, pretty fucking impressive. And then on top of that,
there's a lot of that
is innovation. We just made something up and we took a leap. In fact, you're saying failures. It's like, okay, let's talk about the Red Cabin. We arrived. There's like this horse shed. It stunk pesticides when we arrived. So we had to clean it all up. And we needed to insulate it, and we needed to build some bunks in there. And eventually, Peter Vandenberg, a rocket mass heater expert from Europe, came over here, and he built an experimental rocket mass heater in there called Mini Mouse. And because it's a tiny space, and so you just need a tiny rocket mass heater. And it wasn't performing really well. So another rocket mass heater innovator came along. So it was an experimental thing. Mini Mouse was experimental. So this next second guy, he took that out and he did his own experiment, which he called the Cyclone. And it was different, but it had its problems too. So we took that out. And then we put in this other one, which is a 4-inch J-tube standard rocket mass heater, but it's a 4-inch, and a lot of the experts believe you should never do 4-inch. We're kind of like, yeah, but it's such a small space. Let's do 4-inch and let's get some firsthand feels on why you don't want to do 4-inch. Now I know, don't ever do 4-inch. And so we took it out, but we got a gift from Europe. There's a commercial rocket mass heater in Europe called the Gamera. And so they gave us a Gamera. We put it in. And it did better in a way. But here in about 6 weeks, we're going to take it out. So we've got a rocket mass heater workshop happening this year in about 6 weeks. And one of the projects is going to be to take that out. So what is that? Four that we tried? And so you're saying, what are the failures? And that's like, welcome to the laboratory where we experiment. Now, the Gamera would work great in a home, but this is a cabin. So if you're in a home and you're trying to keep it at like 70, 75 degrees all the time, and then you had a fire yesterday and you got it up to 75, right now it's like 69 degrees. Nice. Then it's going to be like, okay, I want to warm it up. I want to make a fire. Well, okay, you put a fire in it really quick. You run the fire for half an hour, and now you're back at 75. Everything's great. But in a cabin, and then it's 20 degrees outside, it's 20 degrees inside. And it's like, okay, that's a lot of burning that has to happen to get that space warmed up. And the Gamera is a little tiny thing. And granted, it's a smaller space, but it's still going to take hours to warm that space up. On top of that, the Gamera is kind of more like, it's a smaller Gamera, so it's designed to kind of more be like a standalone. Technically, it can do a mass, but you're kind of pushing what it can do. But even more than that, a rocket mass heater is an optimized contraption. And so it works fine if the temperature inside the building is warmer than the temperature outside. So it's like if it's 50 inside and it's 20 outside, it'll work great. But if it's 20 inside and 20 outside, then that's where the optimization fails. That's where you get a downside of the optimization. So the key is that you want a rocket mass heater that's going to be a little less efficient in that scenario. So it'll start better, it get going better, and things like that. Otherwise, it's like it needs a lot of love to get going. And so this space has not been a good fit for the Gamera. So now we're going to take it out. We're going to put a standard 6-inch rocket mass heater in there. And we're going to design it in such a way so that way it'll start good when it's 20 degrees inside and 20 degrees outside. So failures in permaculture, you betcha. And so we're getting better at this all the time. But this is experimental stuff. But I think you're right. I think that surely you've seen the movie Alone in the Wilderness. Everybody watching this or listening to this right now has seen Alone in the Wilderness, right?
Yeah, probably.
That guy built a fucking house in like 5 weeks. But of course, he was a stud who knew what the hell he was doing. And then it's like, okay, now I got this cabin in the middle of Alaska. I ought to build a fireplace or something so I can stay warm. And he probably spends another 5 or 6 weeks building that fireplace. But although when you watch the video later, I think he heats the space more with his cook stove than with the fireplace. fireplace is not designed to be a heat source, really. And I could talk about that for an hour or two. But the key is that it looks like when you look at the chimneys later, when it's like, oh, it's 40 below outside, then it's like it's the chimney from the cook stove that's putting out the smoke, which, you know, it's like that smoke, man, that smoke is fuel, man. But of course, he doesn't know that. He did that. He filmed that, what, 1969? But you're saying a lot of people go up and it's a big, big ass job. And it's like, if you've never built anything before, that's true. It's a huge, huge task. And you are not going to be Dick Prenicky. All right. So it's kind of like it can be done. In fact, Dick Prenicky, one of the first things he did is he planted some rhubarb. He probably planted a few other things and the deer just came along, or the moose came along and just ate it all. The reindeer and all the other animals he was working against. Did he ever get a proper garden going? I don't know. It seems like most of his food came in that plane that flew in like once a month or whatever, bringing him supplies. So you're right. If you don't have the skills, it can be a big leap. That's why we do here. We've got Ant Village and the Deep Roots program.
And tell us about it.
So with Ant Village, you rent an acre for a year and it's like, go for it. You know, you start with raw land and it's like, go for it. What can you do in a year? Some people have built a structure in 5 weeks and they can move in. Other people, 2 years later, they still don't have a structure. And it's like, it depends. And there was one guy, he started to build something. And it's like, I saw what he was building. And I went up and I talked to him. I was like, okay, you're going to have to build something a lot stouter than that. That ain't going to hold. And he didn't believe me. Fortunately, another guy came up and said the same thing. And then suddenly he decided to believe that guy. And so I'm kind of like, man, what do you got to do to be believed around here? You know, but I think what we've seen in Ant Village is about half the people arrive and they kind of poke at the dirt and they do a couple of things, a little of this, a little bit of that, and they learn a lot about themselves. And it's like they probably were complaining about that 40-hour a week job. But I think Dick Prenicky probably was humping 100 hours a week when he was building that cabin. He probably wasn't like, oh, it's been 30 hours. I feel like sitting down with my phone for that. So, no, he just fucking plowed, man. And I think most homesteaders, they have a full-time worky job. And then they do all their homesteading on the evenings and weekends. And so it's like, okay, here you go. You got an acre. Go. Now, for a lot of people, an acre sounds way too small. But I got to tell you, a lot of these people, an acre is way too big. And it's like, it just feels infinite. And it's kind of like, so it's too much. It's too much for most of the people. They suddenly, it's like, oh, I got to go home because my dad died again. But I'll be right back. And I'm kind of like, I don't care. You rented the acre for a year. I ain't giving you your money back. So.
But sorry about your dad again.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Again, yeah. That's unfortunate. He dies over and over. That's wild. So anyway, and then we never see him again. And it's like, but other people come down and they jump into it and they get to it and they accomplish some stuff. And other people, that's what. Now at the boot camp, the boots do 40 hours a week of permaculture, gardening, natural building, stuff like that. And then after a month, we give them their own acre to play on in their spare time, which is plenty for most homesteaders. You know, it's like, oh, I have 40 hours a week. I'm doing a thing. And now I've got all the rest of the week, which to a homesteader, all the rest of the week is a lot. And so then they can go and build all kinds of things. And some of them build things and do things and plant things and do amazing stuff. But most of them, it's like, whew. Man, that was a long day. I need all of Saturday to recover. And it's like, that's fair. That's fine. And here's what I've noticed. People join the boot camp, and if they're here for like 4 or 5 months, after 4 or 5 months, they start doing things beyond the 40 hours a week. They start to get interested. They start doing more and more and more. And when they've been here like a year and a half, Now they're doing like probably an extra 20 to 30 hours a week of stuff that they think is really cool. They're working on their plots, doing interesting things. They're, you know, doing stuff. They're carving a wooden spoon. They're carving a mallet. They're building this, that, and the other thing, building stuff that can go onto their plot that can be part of their homestead future later. And so it's like, they got to get going. They have to get started. Most of the people show up, they don't have the experience, and it takes a while until they kind of start to find their groove. Some people are very enthusiastic and they start carving their first wooden spoon after like 2 weeks. But I think most people, it's more like about 9 months. They're like, hey, can I borrow your spoon carving tools? You know, and then they do their own. Oh, by the way, if you're gonna carve a spoon, always wear gloves, okay? Especially if it's your first time. Definitely wear gloves. Leather gloves, just real durable gloves. Yeah. Little tip for you from Uncle Paul.
Appreciate that.
All right, what was the question? Am I just rambling all over the place here?
No, but that's the entire purpose of the podcast, is just to get a few people together and let them ramble for an hour and a half and see what happens. One thing, if you will, Dave, one thing I want to kind of hit on here is that it seemed to me the question that you originally asked about permaculture's failures, like it seems like the way the question was phrased in the original tweet, it seems to me more that the question was about permaculture comms and branding and communication strategy, less about failures, because the things they listed as failures in permaculture, and I'm thinking like, that's not quite right, because permaculture is a framework for experimentation and lifestyle change that almost necessitates, you know, you mentioned it's a laboratory. You have a laboratory there, which means you're running experiments, which necessarily means you're going to fail over and over and over again. And that is, in fact, the point of what you're doing. So if failure is just another way of learning, then permaculture, there are no permaculture failures, right? It's designed to fail. It's a framework for living that is designed to optimize certain aspects of the natural world and the human's involvement with the natural world. And I find that interesting. That's all preamble for something I heard on your most recent podcast about how you wished, some of the Keystone books were in 1,000 more hands, right? That you talked about permaculture having a branding problem and a marketing problem, a communication strategy problem. And I'm very curious about that, because in my own personal work, that's been a big part of what I've been like trying to solve for as well, of just like, listen, these are strategies that could create mass adoption and alter multiple multi-billion dollar industries. And maybe, and you identified dicks being a big part of the problem, right? As everyone's a dick. And so it's very hard to enter the space. But what have you seen? I mean, it seems to me permies.com is one of your chief kind of missions here has been about putting branding better, like communicating better, marketing the concepts better. What have you learned there? I'm like really curious about what you've learned, 15 years in the game here now of trying to affect that branding problem and trying to like reach more and more people with an idea that should feed billions of people. Right. But that's just the food side. We're not even talking about the ecological restoration side of it. We're not even talking about all the ways in which we can be saving resources and keeping carbon out of the air and all of the ways this touches on things. What have you learned from that? You're in the trenches. You're in the trenches on the branding side. What are you learning?
Okay. I think to respond to what you just said, I bet I could fill 60 books. And so
we'll get started.
We'll get to work. Started,
Paul. New Kickstarter idea.
The first thing I want to do is that you said something about dicks.
Yeah.
And it's like, and you said a problem is the thing about the dicks.
Yeah.
And I want to say the problem is the solution, which is a permaculture expression. And it's kind of like, what does it mean to be a dick? And I think that the thing is that when you point at somebody and say, that guy over there is a dick, then it's like, basically, that guy over there is doing something I'm not cool with. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I think everything we do in permaculture, there are people in corporate America that are not cool with it. And so don't we, therefore, the three of us, aren't we all being dicks? I mean, aren't we bucking the norm? Therefore, we're a bunch of dicks. So Will Wheaton has a famous expression saying, don't be a dick. And I have an expression saying, be a dick. I need people. I think part of it is don't be afraid of people calling you a dick.
Yeah.
Like, get out there, do stuff, make change. And there's going to, and just embrace, there's going to be people pointing at you, calling you a dick. Like that gal that pointed at Sepp Holzer and called him a dick and wrote a book about what a dick this guy is. And it's like, Sepp Holzer's not a dick. She's a bitch. That's what it is. Hell, the judge said
she's
so,
a
right?
Dick. She's being a dick, right? She's like, dick. If you point and say someone's a dick, you got four fingers pointing back at you, or three fingers pointing back at you, right? Like you're exactly. Being the dick, you know?
Can you ever possibly point at anybody and say they're a dick and not be a dick? All right. Like anybody who's pointing at somebody else saying that person's a dick, doesn't it take a dick? Like I think a perfectly lovely person would never point at anybody and say that person's a dick. All right.
Try and find the good.
All right. So if we transcend the dicks, what lessons have you're actually like excellent. You're excellent branding. Like I got to say, like world domination gardening is like you're really, really good at these like pithy phrases that really hit the core of things. So yeah, what have you learned, and what could other people be modeling? Exactly, there it is. And what could other people be modeling after you?
There's just not enough light. If I do it like this, does it show up? World domination gardening. Okay.
So that looks like an incandescent bulb there. What's going on with that?
So well, that's the three movie set, but as a physical DVD, which hardly anybody buys. Although there are some people that are like, their internet is so bad that they want DVDs still. It's kind of unusual. So we have bunches of these DVDs still. It's like, oh, well, in order to move forward, I had to take a risk. So I bought 1,000 of them and I've sold maybe half of the physical DVDs. And it's like, I guess I'm just gonna sit on all these physical DVDs forevermore. But it's like, that's part of it, taking risks. Somebody's gotta take the risk. Everybody wants a sure thing. I think a big part of permaculture is taking the risk. I want to address real quick the thing where you said something about a carbon footprint or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I wanna say a thing to your audience, and that is that half the people listening are like, carbon footprint's a serious thing, and we better get this sorted or we're all gonna die. The other half of your audience is saying, whoever believes that is pretty soft in the head, and they're going to try to leverage that whole carbon footprint thing to fuck up my shit, and I hate them for that. All right, so here I want to say.
Well, you know our audience like perfect. you just dialed it.
So I want to say a thing. First of all, you know, when it comes to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere stuff, it's not like you could say, look, there it goes. I saw it. It's behind that tree. Get the gun. Let's go kill it. It's an invisible thing. It's invisible. And so we're kind of dependent on these people with all of this fancy equipment to tell us like, oh, yeah, it's bigger than it used to be. And so it's like, you know, says who? I wasn't alive back and used to be. And so who was that? Do we know that guy? Is he trustworthy? I don't know. So it's invisible. I think it's fair for people to be skeptical. I mean, that's a big part of science, just being skeptical. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to be skeptical. Now, let's suppose somebody's like, it's a bunch of bullshit. And it's like, okay, here's where I'm at. I'm going to say there's people standing up saying we got to do something about this. And then their path, the thing that they're talking about is, so we got to buy, everybody's got to break down and buy more of those stupid light bulbs. And it's like, the light bulbs don't do shit. They don't. I mean, okay. Some of the stuff on the label is true. And there's a lot of horribleness that's not on the label. And on top of that, I can tell you right now, this incandescent light bulb that you can see right here, I can get this to save me hundreds of dollars a year. And it's quite simple. If you've got natural gas heat or if you've got electric heat, then if you have a heat bubble, so I have a little heat mat here at my keyboard. I have this light, which I can put right over my head, and I've got a dog bed heater at my feet. Now this room can be 50 degrees and it'll feel like 75 to me. So if I can reduce that much off of my heating bill, which I don't have one because of course I have rocket mass heaters now, but I did do testing 10 years ago and all those test results are posted online. The thing is the star of the show is the fucking incandescent light bulb, and it saved me $1,000 in electricity in 1 year. That is more than all the LED light bulbs in anybody's house, no matter how big your house is. In fact, if your LED light bulbs are saving you any significant amount of money, I have to talk to you about how do you light yourself? I think you're wasting a lot of energy on like lighting things that are not there. You know, nobody's in that room. Turn off the fucking lights. So,
well, right. You are describing a great deal of Americans, you know, I mean, like that is the problem, right? Is that the rebuttal to that, right? From a normal average American is, well, I don't want to have a dog bed heater on my feet, and I don't want to have to have a light bulb shining on me. I want every room to be 74 degrees at all times of the year, right? And I want every room to have light. The second I walk in, I want the lights to be on, and I want my home to serve me, right? And that's kind of where, you know, you're talking about different mentalities, you know?
I want that too. I want everybody to be ridiculously comfortable, however they choose to define comfort.
Yep.
All I'm saying is that if you think an LED light bulb is saving you energy, and that's why you bought it, you're wrong.
Yeah.
You are wrong. And it's like, granted, if all you're going to measure is some shitty light coming out of this using like a quarter of the power of an incandescent bulb. But like where I'm at in Montana, when wintertime comes around, it's dark and cold. So yeah, that incandescent light puts out a very efficient form of heat, radiant heat, which is so much better than convective heat, which is how people are heating their homes. So the bottom line is if somebody's going to stand up and say it saves me electricity, I think that person's a fucking idiot. So the thing is that, and this is the whole thing about the book that you just held up a little while ago, Building a Better World in Your Backyard. It's like, what I want is I want to share some ideas, and everything in the book is about adding luxury to your life or putting money in your pocket. And it's like, I don't want to advocate anything that's about sacrifice. Now, backing up just a minute, I was talking about the people that are concerned that their stuff is going to get fucked up because people are screaming global warming. All right. And it's like, okay, here's what I want those people to do. I want those people to be aware of one thing. And that is that. And I'm going to start off by saying the average American carbon footprint is 30 tons per year. That light bulb shit is something like 0.004 tons per year, practically nothing. And buying a Tesla and switching over to a Tesla, that's 2 tons out of 30 tons.
Wait, Paul, are you saying we can't buy our way to a solution?
Okay, put your pants back on. I'm getting here. Give me a second.
You and I don't know each other. I don't wear pants. I only wear shorts. All right.
Put your skirt back on.
So, there we go.
All right. Here we go. Now, if you live in Montana, so remember, it's 30 tons per year is the average per adult in the United States. If you live in Montana and you use electric heat, the average Montana home heated with electricity, 29 tons. Now, and then the average with natural gas used to be considered 9 tons, but more recent numbers have come out that suggest it's closer to 20 tons, okay? 30 tons is the average adult footprint. Now, granted, I'm giving you numbers for an entire home, and it's usually 2 people per home on average, but okay, 29 tons for the average Montana home for electric heat, 20 tons for the average Montana home using natural gas, and then if you use a rocket mass heater to heat your home, 0.4 tons. So if you switch from electric heat to using a rocket mass heater, then you're going to save more, you're going to reduce your carbon footprint more than parking 7 cars completely. That's 14 Teslas, all right? More than 14 Teslas. So I think that if you're a person that's worried about those people fucking up your shit, then I think a good thing to do is to say, so do you have a rocket mass heater? No, then you don't really give a shit about global warming, do you? There you go. Uncle Paul armed you with some magnificent, beautiful stuff. Have a nice day with that. Okay. Some people want to talk about vegan stuff, and it's like some of the stuff that the vegans say is true. Most of it is not. There's some misinformation out there. And so basically your entire diet, the average American diet, has a carbon footprint of 10.5 tons. So if somebody says that most of your carbon footprint has to do with the food that you eat, that's not true. It's not true. And so 10.5 tons. Now, you know what's better? Now, granted, being a vegan, you get to reduce that a little bit. Not as much as they say, but it does reduce it a little bit. What really makes a difference? Growing a garden. Growing a garden does far more, far more. And I would have to say that preppers, I mean, if you're not dabbling in gardening even a little bit, I mean, I don't think you're prepping, are you? I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure if I'm a prepper. People tell me I am, but I don't think I am. But you guys tell me, gardening, that's a prepper thing, isn't it? You got to be doing some gardening if you're a prepper.
I think if you're serious. Yeah, if you're serious about it, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, that's okay. In some respects, like, I feel like, you know, prepper has become like a term that is almost like losing a little bit of its meaning because, A, we all know these systems are collapsing, right? And so it's no longer a fringe attitude for one thing. But also there are so many people that are starting to, you know, experiment with all these different versions of prepping that it's really kind of exploding in variety, you know? And so, you know, yeah, I mean, I would say Doomer Optimists are like, this would be a prepper group 15 years ago, right? But it's now more of like, it's, I don't know, in some respects, it's like a glorified gardening club. You know, I mean, it's very interesting the way that many of the fringe beliefs of preppers has become kind of normalized within these groups where left and right is breaking down a little bit. And it's more of this awareness that the systems are screwing us. So we need to build alternative systems to not just combat that, but provide safe haven for in the future. Right. And so I wouldn't consider you a prepper personally, Paul. So I just consider you a smart guy who's been experimenting with important things for almost 20 years, you know?
The word you used was safety. And it's like, I think that's the key. Why do we get a worky job when we're 19? Because we want to fucking eat and we'd like to live someplace other than, you know,
our mom's basement. The
backseat of a $300 car or our mom's basement. We want to have some security and safety. And really, I think that the natural conclusion is being something, some flavor of some kind of prepper. Like, I don't trust those guys over there making decisions about my food. They're over there voting and it's like, when I read about it, it's like, holy shit, these guys are fucking idiots. they're screwing us. I mean, like right now, the average farmer age is 69. Nice. But it's like, that's the thing is that those guys are getting old and croaking. And then what happens? And it's like, why are the youth not picking it up? And it's like, what, the youth are kind of like, hey, why should I do that when I can go put my naked self on OnlyFans, you know? And it's kind of like, there's all kinds of other opportunities that just doesn't pay anymore. Well, why doesn't it pay anymore? And it's like, because of the commodification of the whole system. Mm-hmm. And basically those old duffers are doing it because that's what they've been doing for the last 40 years. And they're just keep on doing it, even though for a lot of them, it's like, they're not even breaking even. You know, everybody's got a game in the system. I think a beautiful movie is Broken Limbs. You got to watch this Broken Limbs movie. It's very old, but it really drives the point home. It's about the Apple industry. And it's like, man, it just really rocks. And
is that the one about Wenatchee?
Yes.
Okay. I've seen it. Yeah. That's amazing. I loved it. It was crazy, absolutely crazy how the entire industry just broke down because it got too commodified.
Yeah. And it's like almost all of our food systems are that way. So when you start learning about these kinds of things and it's like, oh shit, that's my favorite place to get Fritos. Then it's kind of like, does this mean I'm going to run out of Fritos someday? What's going to happen this fall? What's going on this fall? I don't know. But what's happening next year? I mean, both of you guys are very concerned about the choices being made, and you're kind of like, if I'm going to be safe, I'm a fucking adult. I'm going to do an adult thing. I'm going to stock up. I'm going to buy some pasta because it'll keep for 40 years.
I'm going to plant some trees. I'm going to get some chickens. I'm going to start a goddamn garden.
There you go. Now, if you plant a bunch of stuff in your garden that's a lot of perennials, then it's like you got a worky job that paid a lot of money. That stuff will keep going without you. And then if you come back to it because shit happened, and then it's like, oh, look at all this food coming off of all this stuff right here. If I nurture it a little bit, it'll produce twice as much. Yay.
Paul, could you tell us, coming back to this, the gardening and the perennials, there's one thing that like I always associate with you in the back of my mind. You and Sepp Holzer together, hugelkultur.
Oh, yeah, baby. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about hugelkultur and how are those experiments going?
All right. So the idea of hugelkultur is it's soil on wood. You make a big pile. I really want people to stop doing it in the ground. Don't do that. Make a big pile. You go up 6 or 7 feet tall.
So, why do we go up and not down?
You want to add texture to the landscape for a bunch of different reasons. But you know, the other thing is like when you go down, what do you have that's down? Do you have a bunch of clay? In which case you're kind of making a soup that things won't grow in, or do you have like a swamp, in which case different flavor of soup that things won't grow in? Do you have a lot of floods, which is a seasonal soup that things won't grow in? But then if you go up, it's never a soup. There's never a soup. And on top of that, then when the wind comes along and the wind is very desiccating and cooling, which is generally things you don't want when you're in a cold climate garden. So it acts as a windbreak. And don't we all like to break wind once in a while? And so basically it's gonna be warmer and moister. Moist, okay? And so on top of that, all of that wood on the inside is gonna rot. And as it does, when the winter snow and rain and stuff like that, all that winter moisture comes along, it's going that rotten log on the inside is going to drink up that moisture. It's going to act like a big ass sponge. Then when your garden grows out there and all your different kinds of growies and stuff like that grow out there, there's plenty of water out there and you don't have to irrigate. So with a conventional garden that's flat, and you're going to go away for 2 weeks in August, you know, Disneyland or whatever your thing is, you're going to go away for 2 weeks and you come back to find that the neighbor kid that you paid, basically paid to kill your garden. Yeah, I'll give you some money. I need you to just kill the garden while I'm gone. I need you to lie to me about how much you watered it, even though the evidence is that everything's dead. And you still got your hand out expecting to get paid, and that it, somehow it's my fault that everything dried up despite your ample watering. So instead of that scenario, you don't pay the kid and you go away for 2 weeks and you come back and everything's still doing great. Now, soil on wood, you irrigate it like a regular garden the first year, you irrigate about half as much the second year. You don't have to irrigate it after that. Ta-da! There. Mm. Now, granted, I could fill a few books on just hugel culture, but that gives you a quick idea, right? Mm-hmm.
That's great. Now, one thing you brought up, go ahead.
The World Domination Gardening stuff has a whole movie dedicated to hugel culture. So I talk a lot more on that.
Awesome. And we'll link to that as well. So you brought up this permaculture tool, hugel culture, that is really good for dealing with wind and drought and flooding. Are there other things that people, like there's a lot of climate, like microclimate changes, wildfires are presumed something that's on your mind. What do you have tools or things that you're doing, adaptations you're making at Wheaton Labs to like help protect you against wildfires?
Right. I mean, around here, the big thing that people do to mitigate wildfires is that they do fuel reduction. And what they mean is that they're going to go in and they're going to cut out a lot of the trees that are there. So like if a wildfire came, then the wildfire would struggle to keep going because there'd be less fuel. So fuel is going to be like a little vertical success. So a lot of times, a lot of trees will grow. You'll get like 100 trees growing in a little bunch all together. And then because there's too many competing, most of them die. And then they're just sit there.
They're kindling.
They're kindling, ready to go. It's like, bring on that wildfire. So the government will pay people to go under their own land and do fuels reduction. And so, and then what they do is they take all of that wood, and then they go and they put it in a big pile somewhere and they throw a tarp over it. And then come January, they whip off the tarp and then they light it on fire. So you still have a fire, but now it's a controlled fire. Because in the middle of January, that fire is not, there's snow everywhere. So the fire is not going to get away from the spot. But now here you are and living in Western Montana and the air is smoky as fuck because it's like everybody's doing this. And it's like, does that seem like the permaculture way to you? And I don't think it is. So you are correct, sir. We are doing something a little bit different. Now, I've got a whole podcast dedicated. I did it with Alan Booker. And we go into great detail about what we would do to make it so that a million acres of forest land will be safe from wildfires. And so pretty much it kind of goes like this. Let's suppose that each of you has a 5-acre plot and you're like, you know, running a wood stove or something, like let's say it's a rocket mass heater. On top of that, you're gonna build a wafati. So you got a bunch of wood off of your lot to build the wafati. So you reduce the fuels load already. But for that smaller stuff, you're not gonna build a wafati out of that. That stuff that's, you know, super. So one of the things that we do is we build what we call junk pole fence. So I'm sure you've seen all kinds of things that people have built out of bamboo. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like we're doing that, but with these small sticks that otherwise would be fuel for a wildfire. And so we build these fences out of it. Then the smaller bits that come off of it, we use that for mulch on our gardens. But basically every part of the tree gets used. And now if that same stitch that was up in the air ready to be kindling for a wildfire, if it goes in as part of our fence, the rest of it is on the ground getting nice and soggy and turning into soil, there's nothing there for the wildfire to get hold of. So now, each of you guys, I'm saying you each have like 5 acres and you've done all the things I just described. And now there's not a whole lot of wood on your property. Furthermore, you're kind of like, I have a hard time serving up a chunk of conifer wood for dinner. And so it's not my thing to eat, you know, conifers for dinner. So I've decided that I'm going to have fewer conifers and I'm going to make these hugel cultures and I'm going to grow deciduous trees instead. And I'm going to grow all this other stuff, which turns out to be a little less flammable when the wildfires come through and produces food. So when we have these wildfires, who owns that land and what's their doing? What are they doing there? And it's like, well, it's generally timber companies. Now, granted, timber is lovely, wonderful stuff. I even buy some. I also mill my own and build mostly out of just logs off my property. But I guess that's what I'm kind of advocating is buy less timber, do more with, you know, logs and stuff, or make your own timber, make your own lumber. And in which case it's like now all those companies that have millions and millions of acres of timberland because it's their business and it's a legit business, suddenly they have less. And then and now they have fewer wildfires because it's like, instead of saying like there's one person for every 20,000 acres and that kind of thing, now there's a lot of care to be done to keep it. Because right now they're struggling with beetle kill as well as wildfires. Mm-hmm. Then instead, that land is stewarded by individuals. A big part of this kind of leads into the skip book, because it's kind of like there's millions of acres of farmland every year that are abandoned. The people who had the land died. And then, yeah, there it is, the skip book.
This guy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the land ends up going to the government. And then they just sell it to whoever. And it's like the people who were there before they died, they desperately wished they had somebody that could take it on after they've gone. But they couldn't find anybody and they didn't know anybody and they just couldn't get it sorted out. So it didn't happen. And so, you know, the skip book is all about like trying, because as we put together the skip program, which this is all free, purveys.com/skip. It's all there for free. You don't even need the book.
And for context, skip is skills to inherit property.
Sure. Yes. Yes. And so basically it's kind of like there's this huge chasm between the people who are like, I want to be a homesteader, but I don't have land. And these people that are like, I'm going to die soon. And I wish
somebody I have nobody to take it. Yeah.
I don't have anybody to take it. They can easily find 1,000 people who will take it and sell it and keep the money. And they'll say anything to get it because it'll be like a $2 million property, including $100,000 in the bank and a damn good truck and a damn good tractor and a couple of barns and two homes. And it's like, oh yeah, they would love to be given that property and they'll say anything to get it. So that's the chasm, is to find somebody who's authentically going to keep it going versus somebody who's going to just take it and sell it. And so basically what we've done here is created a list of tasks that you can do and have verified and posted publicly so people can see it and then prove that you're a person who actually gets shit done. Prove that if you were given land, you would take amazing care of it and do amazing things. And so it would be proven. And so we've already been contacted by dozens of people with land looking for somebody to will it to. And yes. I don't know, there's not as many, there are more people with land looking for somebody than there are people participating at this time in the skip program and that are doing these things, that are doing these little things that you can take a picture of and prove it. Okay. About 12 minutes ago, I was asked a question and I went off on four different tangents and I'm sure I dodged. There was something about like reaching people about permaculture, like the permaculture marketing part, like the part of connecting communities, like online or that kind of thing, and as opposed to the on the ground permaculture. There's something about that, right? What was, run that question by me one more time.
Well, I was just very curious because you've been kind of at the forefront of communication, like communications around permaculture has been kind of one of your mini games since the beginning here, right? But what have you learned? What that been like? Because you know you're obviously bumping up against the dominant culture, right? And so you have to make this thing that sounds so alien and so strange palatable and like highlight both the value as well as the, you're not going to like turn into some kind of freak if you see the truth of all this, right?
You're going to be a freak. I mean, let's face it, we're all a bunch of fucking weirdos. I mean, and because we look at what's normal and we find that unappealing. We find it to be not for us. I want to say a quick thing about the click. I have a podcast about the click. Basically, there's a lot of people who, you know, they develop an interest in permaculture and they start like, you know, reading more and attending some events and kind of drinking from the permaculture cup. And then usually for people that go far enough down that road, they get to a point, and we call it the click, where there is a moment in time. And I mean like a second, there is this day with an hour, a minute, and a second where it's like, oh shit, I've been living my whole life backwards up to this moment. And now I see it. Now I see all the pieces of permaculture fit together. And it's not just a bunch of little pieces, it's a big cohesive thing. And from this moment on, I can no longer live my life backwards. I can only go forward. I have to move out of the city now. I have to grow a big garden. I have to do natural building. This is, so the click is the leading cause of divorce amongst permaculture people. There'll be two people who are both keen on permaculture, and one of them will experience the click and the other one will not. And once you experience the click, it's like, I have to leave all of this right now because this is my backwards life that I have to leave. So I wanna put that out there. So first, we have to embrace that we're freaks and weirdos. And once you've experienced the click, it's even more so. It's like, I can't do it that way anymore. I have to do it this whole new way. I have to. And not everybody's experienced the click, but boy, there's a lot of people. And since we put out that podcast about the click, I have heard from more than 100 people that have told me their click story. And it's like, I don't know, maybe you guys have felt it, maybe you haven't, who cares? The thing is that it's a thing, okay? Now, that said, yes, there's a bunch of stuff I've learned. I've got eight years ago, there was Permaculture Voices. It was the biggest, most awesome permaculture conference that has ever happened. And we've got all the video for it on Permies.
I've seen it. I watched all of it.
Perfect. and I... the guy that put it on, Diego Footer, he told me that he wanted me to give a keynote presentation on something for which I had a unique perspective. And what you point out is indeed my unique perspective. And so I liked the keynote I gave the year before for a different event for Diego. That was the 72 Bricks to Build a Better World, which is available for free on YouTube. It's 2.5 hours of me standing in a church, and I never once got struck by lightning. That's video evidence of not getting struck by lightning. All right. So I like that. That's my style. I love that style. But the thing I did for Permaculture Voices is my keynote that year. that was kind of a spanking for the permaculture community. And so it's kind of like, okay, what are the challenges with communication? And it's like, so I broke it down. I called it the presentation. I called it permaculture velocity. And I did a big breakdown of why is permaculture currently not a household word. And I got, I feel like probably a good half of it is our own permaculture community. Our permaculture enthusiasts are holding us back. Rather than being supportive of each other, there's a few that are being very vocal and very hostile. And it's discouraging people from talking about permaculture. Then the next thing is that we have a lot of corporate trolls. The message that we speak for permaculture is contrary to the message of their employer. And they're paid to go onto the internet and advocate their employer's message. There's a lot of, now I know that a lot of people are skeptical about corporate trolls. The evidence about corporate trolls is very profound. So you do your own research, you know, and you make your own decisions. I, of course, run a large website, a large online community. I'm here to say, I think corporate trolls are not only real, but prolific. And so, I mean, there's also spammers, which is the same thing. Corporate trolls are human beings who will engage in a conversation and say, that's bullshit. You know, you can never beat oil. Oil is so good. And, you know, and I got to say, there's a lot of good things to say about oil. I mean, when you get gasoline, that is a very predictable substance. Because Bill Bollison's thing is, permaculture is about replacing petroleum with people. And people are fucking nuts. And so it's kind of like, it's hard. This is a hard thing to do with people. They're so unpredictable. That petroleum is super predictable. So when you go out and you have your big monocrop and a big tractor, it's really predictable how it's going to turn out. Whereas, you know, you get a bunch of people and it's like, oh man, this can go in all sorts of directions. So we're trying. I'm trying to solve the community problem. And it's like, that's really, that's 90% of the problems with permaculture that we're trying to solve is the community problem. How do you get 20 people to live under one roof without stabbing each other? That's the biggest question of them all. I mean, reversing desertification is easy compared to that.
Yeah, well, we've been trying to figure this out for 100,000 years. You know, humans still haven't quite figured it out.
We figured it out, we forgot.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I think you said something earlier about like, boy, the government is really pissing me off and they're doing all these things that scare the shit out of me and this is all new. And I'm like, it's not new, it's different.
Yeah.
It's different. It was a bigger shitstorm 100 years ago. It was just different. Mm-hmm. And it's like, think of, we've come a long, long ways to make things better, but they've gotten better and they've got worse. And it's like, so if you're building a better world in your backyard, this book of mine, the very first paragraph is a quote from Dickens, from A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And so then he goes on about how it's better and it's worse. And it's like, we've got cool things. We've got the internet. We're recording this on Zoom. This is amazing. We're all so far away, but there's video and audio. And later you're going to distribute it as a podcast. That's amazing. Now, at the same time, why doesn't anybody recognize what a fallacy is anymore? They think they listen to the word fallacy and they think, is that some sort of dick? Like that's somebody, like a dick pic or
it's
something?
It's the liberator.
So a fallacy is a deceptive argument. And like, I read all this stuff on the internet. I see the talking heads. And it's like every other phrase is a fallacy. And it's like we just don't study fallacy anymore. It's like nobody, I don't know. It's so bizarre to me how people will make these fallacial arguments that no one seems to care. Everybody's like, well, that sounds about right. Yeah, that sounds, sure, that sounds good. I'm going to do that. Yeah. And it's like, are you fucking kidding me? That was a fallacy. You know, you're gonna base your life on a fallacy. Well, in the meantime, somebody is speaking true over here, and without fallacy, you sound like you're full of shit. It's like Idiocracy. It's you guys have seen Idiocracy. And then the guy comes up and he's saying reasonable things, and it's like, you sound gay. That was the whole argument. Everybody's like, this is the world we live in today.
Yeah.
All right.
So
I think we gotta wrap up here in a minute, but I wanted to just mention just very briefly about the click. Is I heard the click and I had no freaking idea what permaculture was. I heard the click and then I went in search of what it was and I found permaculture. And I want to point that out because I think COVID, the last 6 years in particular, but COVID, like as a point, I think a lot of people heard the click at once and have no idea what how to articulate it or the change that happened in their soul. And I think there's something that permaculture has something to offer that will resonate with what they felt. So I don't know if that's your experience, Paul, or if you're experiencing that as well, Dave. But for me, that's how it happened for me. I mean, I literally, Paul, heard the words make food. I didn't even have a garden at the time. I heard make food. And it was my voice. I wasn't hearing voices. But it was my internal monologue said make food. It was very crystal clear. And so I went in search of how I could make food. And I discovered permaculture. And discovered my co-owner and the business I own. And it completely changed my life, right? And I think a lot of people heard it and they have no idea what they heard or why. They heard a bell toll in the distance and they don't know what was ringing the bell, right? And so I feel like our comm strategy, right, is more important than it's ever been because there's such a huge open wanting audience out there. For one thing, Paul, I would be surprised if you don't get plenty of people asking about Skip once this airs, because regularly in the Doomer Optimism circles are people bemoaning the fact that they can't find cheap land to start their homestead. And I mean, it's an astounding community that is growing up around Doomer Optimism. But even not Doomer Optimism, I mean, the health and wellness field, right? The anti-vaxxer field, like there's all these different groups that are coming to very similar conclusions about the dominant culture. And they're just putting that energy into some bizarre places. And I think permaculture, for one, offers a very interesting solution to the problem that has arisen in their hearts.
I think a person that does Skip could get a property that's a homestead with a garden all ready to go. And I think that there's also people that could, you know, somehow they got some land or they come here where we make it really easy to get people set up on land. But whatever it is that they're doing, that they can kind of get going. But the point I want to make is whichever path that you choose to, it's like when you live in the city, then you really got to pay attention to the politicians. And if the wrong one gets in and starts making poor choices, you could find yourself really fucked and dead. You know, things could go really, really wrong and then you are screwed. Mm-hmm. But when you have a homestead and you're doing permaculture and all that, politics and the city stuff, that's so small and far away. It's like you are so resilient in so many ways that it kind of doesn't matter. I mean, like, let the politicians do whatever they're going to do and screw everything up. And it's like, you know, I hope all those people are okay. It's like when you hear about an earthquake somewhere, I hope all those people are okay. And it's like, but you didn't have an earthquake where you are. And I think that's a big part of it. Now, granted, yes, it can be very, very slow or it can be very, very fast. It depends on the individual. So there's a lot of people that are doing it and they're ready. And there's a lot of people that are doing it and they're not ready. And it's like, I think there's, I mean, in the book, Building a Better World in Your Backyard, I try to explain all the things that'll help to make you resilient. But the thing about where it's the skip book, that's going to be far more about how to be able to, the things that you can do to build those experiences, build skills to get to the point that you might be able to buy from. All right, I got to wrap up, fellas.
Yeah.
Paul, it's my time.
Hey, thank you. Thank you so much. Maybe we do this again because I do want to hear about Seth Holzer and Jeff Lawton and more about Mike Ayler, but thank you so much. We are also, I had an extra copy of Skip, and I believe I have 3 digital copies. So we're going to figure out a way to do a giveaway with the podcast where I'm just going to mail them my extra copy. So we'll figure that out. But thank you, dude. Thank you so much for your time. It's been wonderful.
All right. Bye, guys.
All right.
Thanks, Paul.